In the daytime, Italian doormen with long brooms flipped the snow off your boots every time you went through the swing doors. In the evenings, while Rick and the court banqueted with local lovelies and Dorothy was too tired, Pym would venture on Lipsy's hand through snowy alleys, clutching his penknife in his pocket, while he pretended to himself he was some kind of Russian prince, protecting her from everyone who laughed at her for being serious. And in the morning, after an early levee, he would tiptoe unescorted to the landing and gaze down through the banisters on his army of serfs toiling in the great hall below him, while he sniffed the stale cigar smoke and women's perfume and the wax polish that glistened like dew on the parquet as they buffed it with long sweeps of their mops. And that was how Rick's Bentleys smelt ever after, of the lovelies, of beeswax, of the smoke of his millionaire cigars. And very faintly, from sledge rides through the freezing forest at Lipsy's side, of the cold and the horse dung, while she chatted away in German to the coachman. Back home again, and paradise was pyramids of polished tangerines in silver paper, and pink chandeliers in the dining room, and roaring visits to distant racetracks to flash our owners' badges and watch the never-wasers lose, and a tiny black-and-white television set in a huge mahogany case, which showed the boat race behind a sky of white spots. And when we watched the Grand National, the horses were so far off that Pym wondered how they ever found their way home. But I'm afraid now that Rick's very often didn't, which was why Sid called them never-wasers. And cricket in the garden with Sid. Sixpence if he didn't get Titch out in six balls. And boxing in the drawing room with Morrie Washington, the court expert on the fight game. For Morrie was our Minister for the Arts. He had spoken to Bud Flanagan and shaken hands with Joe Louis. He had played conjurer's stooge to the man with X-ray eyes. And having half-crowns pulled out of your ears by Mr. Muspole, the great accountant, though Mr. Muspole was never my favourite. There was too much of making me do arithmetic in my head. And watching sugar knobs vanish from under Purse Loft's legal Homburg. They were being turned to figments before my very eyes. And piggybacks round the garden on the waistcoated shoulders of the jockeys, who had names like Billy and Jimmy and Gordon and Charlie, and were the best magic makers in the world, the best elves, and read all my comics, and left me theirs when they'd finished them. But always somewhere in this pageant, I can still find Lipsy, now mother, now typist, musician, cricketer, and always Pym's own private moral tutor, flouncing through the outfield in pursuit of a high catch while everyone yelled Achtung at her and whoopsie, mind the flower beds. It was in paradise, too, that Rick kicked a brand new full-size football slap into Pim's young face, which was like being hit by the inside of all the Bentleys at once, the same leather travelling at the same breakneck speed. When he came round, Dorothy was bending over him with a handkerchief crammed between her teeth, whimpering, "Oh, don't, please, dear God, don't," because the blood was everywhere. The football had only cut his forehead, but Dorothy insisted it had shoved the whole eyeball deep into his head, never to be got out again. The poor heart, she was too scared to dab away the blood, so Lipsy had to do it for her, because Lipsy could touch me as she touched wounded animals and birds. I've never met a woman since with so much touching in her hands. And I believe now that was what I meant to her. A thing to touch and cherish and protect after everything else had been removed from her. I was her bit of hope and love in the gilded prison where Rick kept her. In paradise, when Rick was in residence, there was no night, and nobody went to bed but Dorothy, the court's self-appointed sleeping beauty. Pym could join the festival any time he chose, and there they all were, Rick and Sid and Morrie Washington and Purse Loft and Mr. Muspole and Lipsy and the jockeys, lying on the floor amid piles of money, watching the roulette ball hopping over the tin walls, while T.P. and his regalia looked down on them. So there must have been a picture of him in the houses, too. And I see us all dancing to the gramophone and telling stories about a chimpanzee called Little Audrey who laughed and laughed at jokes that were beyond Pym's intellectual reach. But he laughed louder than anyone because he was learning to be a pleaser, with funny voices, acts and anecdotes to make himself attractive. In paradise, everybody loved everybody, because once Pym found Lipsy sitting on Rick's lap, and another time he was dancing cheek to cheek with her, a cigar between his teeth, while he sang underneath the arches, with his eyes shut. And it seemed a pity that Dorothy was once again too tired to put on the frilly dressing gown Rick had bought her. Pink for Dorothy, white for Lipsy. And come on down and have some fun. But the louder Rick yelled to her up the stairs, the deeper Dorothy slept, as Pym discovered for himself when he was dispatched on Rick's instruction to talk her round. He knocked and had no answer. He tiptoed to the enormous bed and brushed what looked at first like cobwebs from her cheek. He whispered to her. Then he tried shouting at her, but with no useful result. Dorothy was crying in her sleep, he reported when he returned downstairs. But next morning everything was all right again, because there were the three of them in bed together, with Rick in the middle, and Pym was allowed to wriggle in beside Lipsy, while Dorothy went down and made the toast, and Lipsy held him gravely to her, and gave him her troubled, moral frown, which I suppose now was her way of telling me she was ashamed of her weakness and infatuation, and wished to cleanse it with her concern for me. In Paradise, it was true, Rick roared, but never at Pym. He never once raised his voice at me. His will was strong enough without it, and his love was stronger still. He roared at Dorothy. He cajoled and warned her about things Pym could not understand. More than once, he carted her bodily to the telephone and made her talk to people, to Uncle Makepeace, to shops, and to others who were threatening us somehow. And only Dorothy could appease them, because Lipsy refused to do that, and anyway her accent wasn't right. I believe now that this was the first time Pym heard the name Wentworth, for I remember Dorothy holding my hand for courage while she told Mrs. Wentworth it would be all right about the money if only everyone would stop pressing. So the name Wentworth was ugly to Pym from early. It became synonymous with fear and an end to things. "Who's Wentworth?" Pym asked Lipsy, and it was the only time she told him to be quiet. And I remember how Dorothy knew all the operators' names at the exchange, and what their husbands and fiancés did, and where their children were at school. Because when she was alone with Pym, and shaky in her Angora pullover, she'd pick up the white phone and have a good chat with them. She seemed to find comfort in a world of disembodied voices. Rick roared at Lipsy, too, when she stood up to him. And I think now that she stood up to him more as I grew up. And sometimes he roared at Dorothy and Lipsy together, making them both weep at the same time, until they all patched it up in the great bed, where he had his toast for breakfast, and dripped the butter on the pink sheets. But no one hurt Pym, or made him cry. I think, even in those days, Pym understood that Rick measured his relationships with women against his relationship with Pym, and found them wanting by comparison. Sometimes Rick took Dorothy and Lipsy skating. Rick wore a black tail suit and a white tie, but Dorothy and Lipsy dressed like pantomime boys, each holding an arm of him and avoiding one another's eye. The fall occurred in darkness. We had been moving house a great deal recently, in what must have been a giddy ascent through the local real estate market, and our palace of the day was a mansion on a hill, and the day was a black winter afternoon near Christmas. Pym had been making paper decorations with Lipsy, and I have a notion that if I could ever find the place, if it is not a council estate or a bypass by now, they would still be hanging there, exactly as we left them. Stars of David and stars of Bethlehem, she taught me the difference precisely, twinkling in enormous empty rooms. First the lights went out in Pym's vast nursery, then the electric fire faded. Then his brand new 10-track Hornby O electric train set wouldn't work. Then Lipsy gave a kind of shriek and vanished. Pym went downstairs and pulled open the walnut lid of Rick's brand new deluxe cocktail cabinet. The mirrored interior refused to light up, and it wouldn't play Someone's in the Kitchen with Dinah. Suddenly, in the whole house, the brass balls of the barometric perpetual clock were the only thing that had retained their energy. Pym ran to the kitchen. No Cookie, and no Mr. Rowley the gardener, whose children stole his toys, but couldn't be blamed because they hadn't his advantages. He ran upstairs again, and feeling very cold, made an urgent reconnaissance of the long corridors, calling, "Lipsy! Lipsy!" But no one answered. From the arched landing window of stained glass, he glared into the garden and made out black cars in the drive. Not Bentleys, but two police Wolseleys, and police drivers with peaked caps sitting at the wheel, and men in brown Macintoshes standing round them, talking to Mr. Rowley, while Cookie twisted her handkerchief and wrung her hands, like the dame in the Crazy Gang pantomime that Rick had taken the court to see only a week before. People under siege go upwards, I now know, which may explain why Pym's reaction was to race up the narrow staircase to the attic. There he found Rick in a great flurry, with files and papers on the floor all round him, and he was loading them by the armful into an old, chipped green filing cabinet that Pym, in all his explorations, had never seen before. "The electricity's broken, and Lipsy's scared, and the police have come, and they're in the garden arresting Mr. Rowley," Pym told Rick in one breath. He said this several times, louder each time, because of the great moment of his message. But Rick wouldn't hear him. He was rushing between the papers and the cabinet, loading up the drawers. So Pym went to him and punched him hard on the upper arm, as hard as he could, on the soft bit, just above the steel spring he wore, to keep his silk shirt sleeve straight. And Rick flung round on him, and his hand went back to strike him, and his face looked like Mr. Rowley's when he was about to make a huge last heave at a log to split it, red and strained and damp. Then he dropped into a crouch, and seized Pym by each shoulder with his thick, cupped hands. And his face worried Pym much more than the axe heave, because his eyes were scared and crying without the rest of his face knowing it, and his voice was smooth and holy. "Don't ever hit me again, son. When I'm judged, as judged we shall all be, God will judge me on how I treated you. Make no bones about it."
"Why are the police here?" said Pym.
"Your old man's got a temporary problem of liquidity. Now clear away to that cupboard and open the door for us like a good chap. Quick." The cupboard was in a corner behind a pile of old clothes and attic junk. Somehow Pym fought his way to the door and hauled it open. With a series of crashes, Rick was slamming shut the doors of the filing cabinet. He turned a lock, grabbed Pym by the arm and poked the key deep into his trouser pocket, which was small and woolly, and only big enough for a key and a small bag of sweets. "You give that to Mr. Muspole, do you hear, son? Nobody but Muspole. Then you show him where this cabinet is. You bring him here and you show him. No one else. Do you love your old man?"
"Yes."
"Well, then." Proud as a sentry, Pym held back the door while Rick swiveled and rolled the cabinet past him on its casters into the cupboard, then into the dark wainscoting beyond. Then he threw in a lot of junk after it, which hid it completely. "See where it went, son?"
"Yes."
"Close the door." Pym did so, then stomped downstairs with his chest out, because he wanted to take another look at the police cars. Dorothy was in the kitchen, dressed in her new fur coat and her new fluffy bedroom slippers, stirring a tin of tomato soup. She had one of those bubbles over her mouth which people get when they're too choked to speak. Pym loathed tomato soup. So did Rick. "Rick's mending the water pipes," he announced grandly, in order to keep his secret intact. This was the only meaning he could place on Rick's reference to liquidity. Yelling ever louder for Lipsy, he charged into the corridor, straight into the path of two policemen, labouring under the weight of a great desk, which was Rick's office when he was at home.
"That's my dad's,"
he said aggressively, putting a hand over the pocket where he had the key. The first policeman is the only one I remember. He was kindly and had a white moustache like T.P.'s, and he was taller than God.
"Yes, well, I'm afraid it's ours now, lad. Hold open that door for us, will you, and mind your toes."
Pym, the official door holder, obliged.
"Your dad got any more desks, has he?" the tall policeman asked.
"No."
"Cupboards? Anywhere he keeps his papers?"
"They're all in there," said Pym, pointing firmly at the desk, while he kept his other hand over the pocket.
"Do you want a wee, then?"
"No."
"Where's some rope?"
"I don't know."
"Yes, you do.
It's in the stable, on a big saddle hook next to the new mower. It's a halter."
"What's your name?"
"Magnus." "Where's Lipsy?"
"Who's Lipsy?"
"She's a lady."
"She work for your dad?"
"No."
"Slip and fetch the rope for us, will you, Magnus? There's a lad. Me and my friends here, we're going to take your dad on a working holiday for a bit, and we need his papers, or nobody can work."
Pym raced off to the shed which was across the other side of the grounds, between the pony paddock and Mr. Rowley's cottage. On the shelf stood a green tea tin, where Mr. Rowley kept his nails. Pym put the key into it, thinking, "Green tin, green filing cabinet." By the time he returned with the halter, Rick was standing between two men in brown raincoats. And I picture it still exactly. Rick so pale that not all the holidays in the world would see him right, commanding loyalty of me with his eyes, and the tall policeman letting Pym try his flat cap on, and push the button that made the bell ring under the bonnet of the black Wolseley. And Dorothy, looking as though she needed a holiday even more than Rick did, not choking any more, but standing still as an effigy, with her white hands folded across her fur coat. Memory is a great temptress, Tom. Paint the tragic tableau. The little group, the winter's day, Christmas in the air, the convoy of Wolseleys bumping away down the lane, which Pym has spent so long patrolling with his new Harrod six-shooter. Rick's desk, lashed to the last car, with the aid of the halter from the stable. Motionless they stare after the cortege as it vanishes into the tunnel of the trees, taking our one provider to Lord knows where. Mrs. Rowley weeping. Cookie howling in Irish. Pym's little head pressed against his mother's bosom. 1,000 violins playing, will you no come back again? There is no limit to the pathos I could not squeeze out of that lemon if I worked on it. Yet the truth, when I make the effort to recall it, is different. With the departure of Rick, a great calm descended over Pym. He felt refreshed and freed of an intolerable burden. He watched the cars leave, Rick's desk last, and he continued to stare anxiously after them, but only for fear that Rick would talk them into turning back. As he watched, Lipsy stepped out of the woods wearing her headscarf and struggled towards him, weighed down by the cardboard suitcase that contained her life's possessions. The sight of her made Pym even more furious than he'd been when he'd found Dorothy making soup. "You hid," he accused her, in the secret dialogue he constantly conducted with her. "You were so scared you hid in the wood and missed the fun." I realize now, of course, but could not at the time, that Lipsy had seen people taken away before, her brother Aaron, and the architect her father, to mention only two. But Pym, in common with the rest of the world, cared little about pogroms in those days, and all he could feel was a deep resentment that his life's love had failed to rise to an historic moment. Muzzpole came that evening. He arrived at the side door with a cooked chicken for us, and a rhubarb pie and thick custard, and a thermos of hot tea, and he said he was making arrangements for us, and everything would be fine tomorrow. To get him on his own, Pym said, "Come and see my Hornby." And at once Dorothy cried, because by then there was no Hornby. The distraining bailiffs had fought a pitched battle with the repossessing shopkeepers, and the Hornby had been one of the first things to go. But Mr. Muzzpole went with Pym anyway, and Pym took him to the shed and gave him the key, then led him to the attic and showed him the secret. And everybody watched again, while Mr. Rowley and Mr. Muzzpole heaved and puffed and loaded the cabinet onto Mr. Muzzpole's car, and waved again when Mr. Muzzpole drove into the twilight in his hat. After the fall came, very properly, purgatory. And purgatory possessed no Lipsies. I guess she was trying to make one of her breaks from me, using Rick's absence to cut herself off. Purgatory was where Dorothy and I served out our sentence, Tom, and purgatory is just over the hill from here, a few of Rick's fair stages along the coast, though the new timeshare apartments have removed much of its sting. Purgatory was the same wooded hollow of clefts and chines and dripping laurels where Pym had been conceived, with red windswept beaches always out of season, and creaking swings and sodden sandpits that were closed to enjoyment on the Sabbath, and for Pym on any other day as well. Purgatory was Makepeace Watermaster's great sad house, the Glades, where Pym was forbidden to leave the walled orchard if it was dry, or enter the main rooms if it was raining. Purgatory was the tabernacle with the Knight Schoolboys written clean out of the history books, and Makepeace Watermaster's frightful sermons, and Mr. Philpot's sermons, and sermons from every aunt, cousin, and neighbourhood philosopher,
who felt moved to words by Rick's misfortune, and saw the young criminal as the proper person to address. Purgatory possessed no cocktail cabinets, television sets, jockeys, Bentleys, or never-wasers, and served bread and margarine instead of buttered toast. When we sang, we droned, "There is a green hill far away," and never underneath the arches, or one of Lipsy's leader. Contemporary photographs show a grinning, toothy child, well-grown and well-looking enough, but stooped, as if from living under low ceilings. All are out of focus. All have a furtive, stolen look about them. And I try to love them only because I believe Dorothy must have taken them, though it was Lipsy whom Pym was missing. In a couple, the child is tugging at the arm of whatever mother happens to attend him, probably trying to persuade her to come away with him. In one, he is wearing sloppy white gloves, like puppet's hands. So I suppose he suffered from some skin disease, unless Makepeace was worried about fingerprints. Or perhaps he was intending to become a waiter. The mothers, all large, all dressed in the same strict uniform, have such an air of the wardress about them that I seriously wonder whether Makepeace obtained them from an agency specializing in the care of delinquents. One wears a medal like an iron cross. I do not mean they are without kindness. Their smiles are alight with pious optimism. But there is something in their glance that assures me they are alert at all times to the latent criminality of their charge. Lipsy is not featured, and my poor Dorothy, Pym's one cellmate in the dark rear wing to which the two of them were confined, was even more useless than before. If Pym was thrashed, Dorothy would dress his wounds, but never question the need for them. If he was put into shameful nappies as a punishment for wetting his bed, Dorothy would urge him not to drink in the second part of the day. And if he was denied tea altogether, Dorothy would save him her biscuits and pass them to him in the privacy of their upper room, poking them one by one between the invisible bars. In Paradise, on good days, Pym and Dorothy had managed to share the occasional joke together. Now the guilty silence of her house reclaimed her. Each day drove her further into herself, and though he told her his best jokes, and did his best acts for her, and painted the best pictures for her that he knew, nothing he could do was able to wake her smile for long. At night, she moaned and ground her teeth, and when she switched the light on, Pym lay awake beside her, thinking of Lipsy, and watching Dorothy's unblinking eyes, staring up at the parchment Star of Bethlehem that was their lampshade. If Dorothy had been dying, Pym could have gone on nursing her forever. No question. But she wasn't. So he resented her instead. In fact, soon he began to weary of her altogether and wonder whether the wrong parent had gone on holiday, and whether Lipsy was his real mother, and he had made an awful mistake, the one that accounted for everything. When war broke out, Dorothy was incapable of rejoicing at the marvellous news. Makepeace turned on the wireless, and Pym heard a solemn man saying he had done everything he could to prevent it. Makepeace turned off the wireless, and Mr. Philpot, who had come for tea, asked mournfully, where, oh where, would the battlefield be? Makepeace, never at a loss, replied that God would decide. But Pym, spilling over with excitement, for once presumed to question him. But Uncle Makepeace, if God can decide where the battlefield is, why doesn't he stop the battle altogether? He doesn't want to. He could if he wanted to. Easy. He doesn't. Even to this day, I do not know which was the greater sin, to question Makepeace or to question God. In either case, the remedy was the same. Put him on bread and water like his father. But the worst monster in the glades was not rubbery Uncle Makepeace with his little rose ears, but mad Aunt Nell in her livid-coloured spectacles, who chased after Pym with no reason, waving her stick at him and calling him my little canary, because of the yellow pullover Dorothy had managed to knit him while she wept. Aunt Nell had a white stick for seeing with, and a brown stick for walking with. She could see perfectly well, except when she carried her white stick. Aunt Nell gets her wobblies out of a bottle, Pym told Dorothy one day, thinking it might make her smile. I've seen. She's got a bottle hidden in the greenhouse. Dorothy did not smile, but became very frightened, and made him swear never to say such a thing again. Aunt Nell was ill, she said. Her illness was a secret, and she took secret medicine for it.
and nobody must ever know, or Aunt Nell would die, and God would be very angry.
For weeks afterwards, Pym carried this wonderful knowledge round with him, much as, briefly, he had carried Rick's. But this was better and more disgraceful. It was like the first money he had ever owned, his first piece of power. Who to spend it on, he wondered. Who to share it with? Shall I let Aunt Nell live, or shall I kill her for calling me her little canary? He decided on Mrs. Bannister, the cook. Aunt Nell gets her wobblies out of a bottle, he told Mrs. Bannister, careful to use exactly the form of words that had so appalled Dorothy. But Aunt Nell did not die, and Mrs. Bannister knew about the bottle already, and cuffed him for his forwardness. Worse still, she must have taken his story to Uncle Makepeace, who that night made a rare visit to the prison wing, swaying and roaring and sweating, and pointing at Pym while he talked about the devil, who was Rick. When he had gone, Pym made his bed across the door, in case Makepeace decided to come back and do some more roaring. But he never did. Nevertheless, the burgeoning spy had acquired an early lesson in the dangerous business of intelligence. Everybody talked. His next lesson was no less instructive, and concerned the perils of communication in occupied territory. By now, Pym was writing to Lipsy daily, and posting his letters in a box that stood at the rear gate of the house. They contained, to his later shame, priceless information, almost none of it in code. How to break into the glades at night, his hours of exercise, maps, the character of his persecutors, the money he had saved, the precise location of the German guards, the route to be followed through the back garden, and where the kitchen key was kept. "I have been kidnapped to a dangerous house. Please get me quick," he wrote, and enclosed a drawing of Aunt Nell, with canaries coming out of her mouth, as a further warning of the hazards that surrounded him. But there was a snag. Having no address for Lipsy, Pym could only hope that somebody at the post office would know where she was to be found. His confidence was misplaced. One day, the postman delivered the whole top-secret bundle to Makepeace personally, who summoned the prevailing mother, who summoned Pym, and led him like the convict he was to Makepeace for chastisement, though he simpered and begged and flattered him for all he was worth. For Pym, somewhat unsportingly, hated the lash, and was seldom gallant about receiving it. After that, he contented himself with looking for Lipsy on buses, and, where he could do so deniably, asking people who happened to be passing the rear gate whether they had seen her. Particularly he asked policemen, whom he now smiled at richly wherever he found them. "My father's got an old green box with secrets in," he told a constable one day, strolling in the memorial gardens with a mother.
"Has he then, son? Well, thanks for telling us," said the constable, and pretended to write in his notebook.
Meanwhile, word of Rick, though not of Lipsy, reached Pym like the unfinished whispers of a distant radio transmitter. "Your father is well. His holiday is doing him good. He has lost weight. Lots of good food. We're not to worry. He's getting exercise, reading his law books. He's gone back to school." The source of these priceless snippets was the other house, which lay in a poorer part of Purgatory down by the coking station, and must never be mentioned in front of Uncle Makepeace, since it was the house that had spawned Rick, and brought disgrace on the great family of Watermaster, not to mention the memory of T.P. Hand in hand, Dorothy and Pym rode there in fireside darkness, sticky mesh against bomb blast on the windows of the trolley bus, and the lights inside burning blue to baffle German pilots. At the other house, a steadfast little Irish lady with a rock jaw gave Pym half a crown out of a ginger jar, and squeezed his arm muscles approvingly, and called him son, like Rick. And on the wall hung a copy of the same tinted photograph of T.P., framed not in gold, but in coffin wood. Jolly-faced aunts made sweets for Pym out of their sugar ration, and hugged and wept, and treated Dorothy like the royalty she once had been, and hooted when Pym did his funny voices, and clapped when he sang underneath the arches. "Go on, Magnus, give us some Makepeace, then." But Pym dared not, for fear of God's anger, which he knew from the Aunt Nell affair to be swift and awful. The aunt he loved most was Bess.
"Tell us, Magnus," whispered Aunt Bess to him, alone in the scullery, drawing his head close to her own. Is it true your dad ever owned a racehorse called Prince Magnus after you?
It's not true, said Pym, without a second's thought, remembering the excitement as he sat beside Lipsy on her bed, listening to the commentary of Prince Magnus coming nowhere. It is a lie made up my uncle Makepeace to hurt my father.
Aunt Bess kissed him and laughed and wept in relief and held him even tighter.
Never say I asked you. Promise.
I promise, said Pym. God's honour.
The same Aunt Bess, one glorious night, smuggled Pym out of the Glades and into the Pier Theatre, where they saw Max Miller and a row of girls with long bare legs like Lipsy's. On the trolley bus back, brimming over with gratitude, Pym told her everything he knew in the world, and made up whatever he didn't. He said he had written a book by Shakespeare, and it was in a green box in a secret house. One day he would find it and print it, and make a lot of money. He said he would be a policeman, and an actor, and a jockey, and drive a Bentley like Rick, and marry Lipsy and have 6 children, all called T.P., like his granddad. This pleased Bess enormously, except for the bit about the jockey, and sent her home, saying Magnus was a card, which was what he wanted most. His gratification was short-lived. This time, Pym had made God very angry indeed, and as usual, he was not slow to do something about it. On the very next day before breakfast, the police came and took away his Dorothy for ever, though the reigning mother said they were only ambulance. And once again, though Pym dutifully wept for Dorothy, and refused food for her, and flailed with his fists at the long-suffering mothers, he could not but see their rightness in removing her. They were taking her to a place where she would be happy, the mother said. Pym envied her luck. Not to the same place as Rick, no, but somewhere nicer and quieter, with kind people to look after her. Pym planned to join her. Escape, till now a fantasy, became his serious aim. A celebrated epileptic at Sunday school acquainted him with his symptoms. Pym waited a day, ran into the kitchen with his eyes rolling, and collapsed dramatically before Mrs. Bannister, shoving his hands into his mouth and writhing for good measure. The doctor, who must have been a rare imbecile, prescribed a laxative. Next day, in a further attempt to draw attention to himself, Pym hacked off his forelock with paper scissors. No one noticed. Improvising now, he released Mrs. Bannister's cockatoo from its cage, sprinkled soap flakes into the Aga cooker, and blocked the lavatory with a feather boa belonging to Aunt Nell. Nothing happened. He was beating the air. What he needed was a great dramatic crime. All night he waited. Then, early in the morning, when his courage was highest, Pym walked the length of the house to Makepeace Watermaster's study in his dressing gown and slippers, and relieved himself prolifically over the centre of the white carpet. Terrified, he threw himself onto the patch he had created, hoping to dry it out with the heat of his body. A maid entered and screamed. A mother was summoned, and from his anguished position on the carpet, Pym was treated to a formative example of how history rewrites itself in a crisis. The mother touched his shoulder. He groaned. She asked him where it hurt. He indicated his groin, the literal cause of his distress. Makepeace Watermaster was fetched.
What were you doing in my study in the first place?
The pain, sir. The pain. I wanted to tell you about the pain.
With a screech of tires, the doctor returned. And now everything was remembered, while he bent over Pym and probed his stomach with his stupid fingertips. The collapse before Mrs. Bannister, the nightly moans, the daily pallor, Dorothy's madness, discussed in hushed terms. Even Pym's bedwetting was taken down and used in evidence on his behalf.
Poor boy, it's got him here as well, said the mother,
as the patient was lifted cautiously to the sofa, and the maid was hurried off to fetch Jay's disinfectant and a floorcloth. Pym's temperature was red and grimly observed to be normal.
Doesn't mean a thing, said the doctor,
now battling to make good his earlier negligence, and ordered the mother to pack the poor boy's things. She did so, and in the course of it must inevitably have discovered a number of small objects that Pym had taken from other people's lives in order to improve his own. Nell's jet earrings, Cook's letters from her son in Canada, and Makepeace Watermaster's travels with a donkey,
which Pym had selected for its title, the only part he had read. In the crisis, even this black evidence of his criminality was ignored. The outcome was more effective than Pym could have hoped. Not a week later, in a hospital newly fitted to receive victims of the approaching Blitz, Magnus Pym, aged 8.5 years, yielded up his appendix in the interests of operational cover. When he came round, the first thing he saw was a blue and black koala bear, larger than himself, seated on the end of his bed. The second was a basket of fruit bigger than the bear, which looked like a piece of St. Moritz that had landed by mistake in wartime England. The third was Rick, slim and smart as a sailor, standing to attention, with his right hand lifted in salute. Beside Rick again, like a scared ghost dragged unwillingly from the shades of Pym's chloroformed realm, came Lipsy, hunched to the shoulders by a new fur cape, and supported by Sid Lemon, looking like his own younger brother. Lipsy knelt to me. The two men looked on while we embraced.
"That's the way, then," Rick kept saying approvingly. "Give him a good old English hug, that's the way."
Softly, like a bitch recovering her pup, Lipsy picked me over, lifting the remains of my forelock, and staring gravely into my eyes, as if fearing that bad things had got into them. How they celebrated their relief, shorn of all possessions except the clothes they stood up in and the credit they could muster as they went along. Rick's reconstituted court took to the open road and became crusaders through wartime Britain. Petrol was rationed. Bentleys had vanished for the duration. All over the country, posters asked, "Is your journey really necessary?" And every time they passed one, they slowed down to yell back, "Yes, it is!" in chorus through the open windows of their cab. Drivers either became accomplices or left in a hurry, and Mr. Humphreys threw them all into the street in Aberdeen after a week, calling them crooks, and drove away without his money, never to be seen again. But a Mr. Cudlove, whom Rick had met on holiday, and who had got the court a week's tick at the Imperial at Torquay, on the strength of an aunt who worked in the accounts department, he stayed forever, sharing their food and fortunes, and teaching Pym tricks with string. Sometimes they had one taxi. Sometimes Mr. Cudlove's special friend, Ollie, brought his Humber, and they had day-long races for Pym's sole benefit, with Sid leaning out of the back window, giving the car the whip. Of mothers, they had a dazzling and varying supply, and often acquired them at such short notice they had to cram them into the back, too deep, with Pym squeezed into an exciting, unfamiliar lap. There was a lady called Topsy, who smelt of roses, and made Pym dance with his head against her breast. There was Millie, who let him sleep with her in her siren suit because he was frightened of the black cupboard in his hotel bedroom, and who bestowed frank caresses on him while she bathed him. And Eileen's and Mabel's and Joan's, and a Violet who got carsick on cider, some into a gas mask case, and the rest over Pym. And when they were all got out of the way, Lipsy materialized, standing motionless in the steam of a railway station, her cardboard suitcase hanging from her slim hand. Pym loved her more than ever, but her deepening melancholy was too much for him, and in the whirl of the Great Crusade, he resented being the object of it. "Old Lipsy's got a touch of the what's-its," Sid would say, kindly, noting Pym's disappointment, and they'd heave a bit of a sigh of relief together when she left. "Old Lipsy's on about her dues again," said Sid, sadly, another time. "They keep telling her another lot's been done." And once, "Old Lipsy's got the guilts. She isn't dead like them." Pym's intermittent inquiries after Dorothy led him nowhere. "Your mum's poorly," Sid would say. "She'll be back soon, and the best thing Aunt Magnus here can do for her meantime is not fret over her, because it will only get to her and make her worse." Rick took a wounded line. "You'll just have to put up with your old man for a while. I thought we were having fun then. Aren't we having fun?" "All the fun in the world," said Pym. On the subject of his recent absence, Rick was as sparing as the rest of the court, so that soon Pym began to wonder whether they had ever been on holiday at all. Only the occasional hint convinced him that they had shared a cementing experience. Winchester had been worse than Reading because of those bloody gypsies off of Salisbury Plain, Pym once overheard Morrie Washington tell Purse Loft. Sid backed him up,
Those Winchester gippos was rough, you wouldn't believe, said Sid, with feeling. The screws was no better either.
And Pym noticed that their holiday had made hearty eaters of them.
Eat your peas now, Magnus, Sid urged him, amid much laughter. There's worse hotels than this one, we can tell you.
It wasn't till a year or more later, when Pym's vocabulary had grown equal to his intelligence gathering, that he realized they had been talking about prison. But their leader did not share these jokes, and they ceased abruptly. For Rick's gravitas was something no man tampered with lightly, least of all those appointed to uphold it. Rick's superiority was manifest in everything he did, in the way he dressed, even when we were very broke, his clean laundry and clean shoes, in the food he required, and the style to eat it in, the rooms he had in the hotel, in the way he needed brandy for his snooker and scared everyone into silence with his brooding, in his preoccupation with good works, which involved visiting hospitals where people had taken bad knocks and seeing the old people write while their children were away at the war. "Will you see Lipsy write too when the war's over?" Pym asked one day.
"Old Lipsy's crackerjack," said Rick.
Meanwhile, we traded. What in? Pym never rightly knew, and nor do I now. Sometimes in rare commodities such as hams and whiskey, sometimes in promises, which the court called faith. Other times in nothing more solid than the sunny horizons that sparkled ahead of us down the empty wartime roads. When Christmas approached, somebody produced sheets of coloured crepe paper, thousands of them. For days and nights on end, augmented by extra mothers recruited for this vital war work, Pym and the court crouched in an empty railway carriage at Didcot, twisting the paper into crackers that contained no toys and would not crack, while they told each other wild stories and cooked toast by laying it on top of the paraffin stove. Some of the crackers, it was true, had little wooden soldiers inside them, but these were called samples and kept separate.
The rest, Sid explained, were for decoration, Titch, like flowers when there isn't any.
Pym believed it all. He was the most willing child labourer in the world, so long as there was approval waiting for him round the corner. Another time they towed a trailer filled with crates of oranges, which Pym refused to eat because he overheard Sid saying they were hot. They sold them to a pub on the road to Birmingham. Once they had a load of dead chickens, which Sid said they could move only at night when it was cold enough. So perhaps that was what had gone wrong with the oranges. And there is a clip of film running forever in my memory. It shows a scraggy, moonlit hilltop on the moors, and our two cabs with our lights out, winding nervously to the crest, and the dark figures standing waiting for us on the back of their lorry, and the masked lamp as they counted out the money for Mr. Muspole, the great accountant, while Sid unloaded the trailer. And though Pym watched from a distance, because he hated feathers, no night frontier crossing later in his life was ever more exciting. "Can we send the money to Lipsy now?" Pym asked. "She hasn't got any left."
"Now how do you know a thing like that, old son?"
"From her letters to you," Pym thought. "You left one in your pocket and I read it." But Rick's eyes had their flick knife glint, so he said,
"I made it up,"
and smiled. Rick did not come on our adventures. He was saving himself. What for was a question nobody asked within Pym's hearing, and certainly he never asked it for himself. Rick was devoting himself to his good works, his old people, and his hospital visiting.
"Is that suit of yours pressed, son?" Rick would say,
when, as a special privilege, father and son embarked together on one of these high errands.
"God in heaven, Muspole, look at the boy's suit. It's a damn shame. Look at his hair."
Hastily, a mother would be ordered to press the suit, another to polish his shoes and get his fingernails proper, a third to comb his hair till it was orderly and sensitive. With flimsy patience, Mr. Cudlove tapped his keys on the car roof, while Pym was given a final check over for signs of unintentional irreverence. Then away at last they sped to the house or bedside of some elderly and worthy person, and Pym sat fascinated to see how swiftly Rick trimmed his manner to suit theirs, how naturally he slipped into the cadences and vernacular that put them most at ease,
and how the love of God came into his good face when he talked about liberalism and masonry and his dear dead father, God rest him, and a first-class rate of return, 10% guaranteed plus profits for as long as you're spared. Sometimes he brought a ham with him as a gift and was an angel in a hamless world. Sometimes a pair of silk stockings or a box of nectarines. For Rick was always the giver, even when he was taking. Where he was able, Pym threw his own charm into the scales by reciting a prayer he had composed, or singing Underneath the Arches, or telling a witty story with a range of regional accents that he had picked up in the course of the crusade. "The Germans are killing all the Jews," he said once, to great effect. "I've got a friend called Lipsy, and all her other friends are dead." If his performance was wanting, Rick let him know this without brutality. When somebody like Mrs. Ardmore asks you whether you remember her son, don't scratch your old head and pull a face. Look her in the eye and smile and say, "Yes." That's the way to treat old people, and to be a credit to your father. Do you love your old man?
Of course I do.
Well then, how was your steak last night?
It was super.
There's not 20 boys in England ate steak last night. Do you know that?
I know.
Give us a kiss, then. Sid was less reverent. "If you're going to learn to shave people, Magnus," he said, over a lot of winks, "you've got to learn how to rub the soap in first." Somewhere near Aberdeen, without warning, the court became interested only in chemist shops. We were a limited company by then, which to Pym was as good as being a policeman. Rick had found a new banker, with faith. Mr. Cudlove's live-in friend Ollie signed the checks. Our product was a concoction of dried fruit that we pulped with a hand press in the kitchens of a great country house, belonging to a dashing new mother called Cherry. It was a large house with white pillars at the front door, and white statues all like Lipsy in the garden. Even in paradise, the court had never stayed anywhere so grand. First we stewed the fruit and pulped it in the press, which was the best bit. Then we added gelatine to make lozenges out of it, which Pym rolled round and round in company sugar with his bare palm, licking it clean between batches. Cherry had evacuees and horses, and gave parties for American soldiers, who presented her with cans of petrol in the tithe barn. She owned farms, and a great park with deer, and an absent husband in the Navy, whom Sid referred to as the Admiral. In the evenings before dinner, a pack of King Charles Spaniels was whipped in by an old gamekeeper. They swarmed over the sofas, yapping, till they were whipped out again. At Cherry's, for the first time since St. Moritz, Pym saw silver candles on the dinner table, lighting bare shoulders. "There's a lady called Lipsy who's in love with my father, and they're going to marry and have babies," Pym told Cherry helpfully one evening, as they walked together down the ride, and was greatly impressed by how seriously Cherry took this news, and how intently she questioned Pym concerning Lipsy's accomplishments. "I've seen her in the bath, and she's beautiful," said Pym. And when they left a few days later, Rick took something of the dignity of the place with him, and something of its proprietor also, for I remember him striding down the great stone steps with a white hide suitcase in each hand. Rick always loved a fine suitcase, and sporting a smart country outfit of the sort no admiral would wear to sea. Sid and Mr. Muspole followed after him like circus midgets, clutching the chipped green filing cabinet between them, and shouting, "Your end, Deirdre," and "Gently down the stairs, Sybil." "Don't you ever talk to Cherry about Lipsy again, son," Rick warned Pym, in his heaviest moralistic tone. "It's high time you learned it's not polite to mention one woman to another, because if you don't learn that, you'll waste your advantages, and that's a fact." It was through Cherry also, I suspect, that Rick formed the determination to turn Pym into a gentleman. Until now, it had been assumed that Pym was already of the aristocracy. But Cherry, a forceful and superior woman, taught Rick that true English privilege was obtained by hardship, and that the best hardship was to be found at English boarding schools. She also had a nephew at Mr. Grimble's academy by the name of Sefton Boyd, but better known to her as My Darling Kenny. A second and less tender influence was the army. First Muspole became its casualty, then Morrie Washington,
then Sid. Each with a rueful smile of failure, packed his little suitcase and disappeared, returning only seldom and with very short hair. Then one day, to his hurt surprise, Rick himself was summoned to the flag. In later life, he took a more tolerant view of the pettiness of the society entrusted to his care. But the sight of his call-up papers on the breakfast table provoked an outburst of righteous anger. "God damn it, Loft! I thought we'd taken care of all that," he raged at Purse, who was exempt from everything.
"We did take care of it," said Purse, jabbing a thumb in my direction. "Delicate kid, mother in the nut house, it's watertight compassion."
"Well, where the devil's their compassion now, then?" Rick demanded, shoving the buff document under Percy's nose. "It's a damn shame, Loft. That's what it is. Get after it."
"You never ought to have told old Cherry about Lipsy," Purse Loft fumed at Pym later. "She went and peached on your dad out of spite."
But the army declined to surrender, and the depleted court, consisting of Purse Loft, a clutch of mothers, Ollie and Mr. Cudlove, duly uprooted itself to a drab hotel in Bradford, where Rick was obliged to reconcile the ignominy of the parade ground with the burdens of financial generalship. Using the hotel's coin box and the hotel's credit, typing and filing in the hotel's bedrooms, storing their mysterious wares in the hotel's garage, the court fought a gallant rearguard action against dissolution. But in vain. It was Sunday evening in the hotel. Rick, in his private's uniform, freshly pressed, was preparing to return to barracks. A new darts board was wedged under his arm, which he planned to present to the sergeant's mess, for Rick had his heart set on the post of catering clerk, which would enable him to see us right in the shortages.
"Son, it's time for you to set those fine feet of yours on the hard road to becoming Lord Chief Justice, and a credit to your old man. There's been too much lazy fare about, and you're part of it. Cudlove, look at his shirt. No man ever did business in a dirty shirt. Look at his hair. He'll be an airy fairy before you can say Jack Robinson. It's boarding school for you, son. And God bless you. And God bless me, too."
One more bear hug, a final staunching of the tears, one noble handshake for the absent cameras, as, darts board at the ready, the great man rode away to war. Pym watched him out of sight, then stealthily climbed the stairs to the provisional state apartments. The door was unlocked. He smelt woman and talc. The double bed was in disarray. He pulled the pigskin briefcase from beneath it, tipped out the contents, and, as he had often done before, puzzled over unintelligible files and correspondence. The Admiral's country suit, donned for a few hours and still warm, was hanging in the wardrobe. He poked in the pockets. The green filing cabinet, more chipped than ever, lurked in its habitual darkness. "Why does he always keep it in cupboards?" Pym tugged vainly at the locked drawers. "Why does it travel separately from everything, as if it had a disease?"
"Looking for money, are we, Titch?" a woman's voice asked him from the bathroom doorway. It was Doris, typist-elect and good scout. "Spare yourself the trouble, I would. It's all tick with your dad, I've looked."
"He told me he'd left me a bar of chocolate in his room," Pym replied resolutely, and continued delving while she watched.
"There's 3 gross of army milk and nuts sitting in the garage. Help yourself," Doris advised. "Petrol coupons, too, if you're thirsty."
"It was a special kind of bar," said Pym. I have never fathomed the machinations that sent Pym and Lipsy to the same school. Were they infiltrated singly or as a package? The one to be taught, the other to supply her labour in payment. I suspect as a package, but have no proof beyond a general knowledge of Rick's methods. All his life, Rick maintained a workforce of devoted women, whom he regularly discarded and revived. When they were not required in the court, they were put out to work for him in the great world, easing his crusade with remittances they could ill afford, selling their jewellery for him, cashing their savings, and lending their names to bank accounts from which Rick's name was banned. But Lipsy had no jewellery and no credit with the banks. She had only her lovely body and her music and her brooding guilt and a little English schoolboy who held her to the world. I suspect now that Rick had already read the warning signs collecting in her and decided to give her to me to look after.
Nevertheless, there was profit to our partnership, and Rick was nothing if not an opportunist. If Pym possessed any learning by the time he presented himself to Mr. Grimble's Country Academy for the Sons of Gentlemen, then he owed it to Lipsy, and not to any of the dozen or so infant schools, Bible schools and kindergartens scattered along the hectic road of Rick's progress. Lipsy taught him writing, and to this day I write a German T and put a stroke through my small Zs. She taught him spelling, and it was always a great joke between them that they could not remember how many D's there were in the English version of address. And to this day I can't be sure of the answer until I've written out the German first. Whatever else Pym knew, apart from meaningless passages of the scriptures, was contained in her cardboard suitcase, for she never came to see him anywhere without whisking him to her room and foisting some piece of geography or history on him, or making him play scales on her flute. See, Magnus, without informations we are nothing, but with informations we can go anywhere in the world. We are like turtles, our houses always on our backs. You learn to paint, you can paint anywhere. A sculptor, a musician, a painter, they need no permits, only their heads. Our world must be inside our heads. That is the only safe way. Now you play Lipsy a nice tune.
The arrangement at Mr. Grimble's was the perfect flowering of this relationship. Their world was inside their heads, but it was also contained in a brick and flint gardener's cottage at the end of Mr. Grimble's long drive, designated the Overflow House, and occupied by the Overflow boys, of whom Pym was the newest recruit. And Lipsy, his lovely lifelong Lipsy, their best and most attentive mother. They knew at once they were outcasts. If they didn't, the 80 boys up the drive made it plain to them. They had a pallid grocer's son without an H to his name, and tradesmen were ridiculous. They had 3 Jews, whose speech was spattered with Polish, and a hopeless stammerer called Marlin, and an Indian with knock knees, whose father was killed when the Japanese took Singapore. They had Pym, with his spots and wet beds. Yet, under Lipsy, they contrived to glory in all these disadvantages. If the boys up the drive were the crack regiment, the Overflow boys were the irregulars who fought all the harder for their medals. For staff, Mr. Grimble took what he could get. And what he could get was whatever the country didn't need. A Mr. O'Malley punched a boy so hard across the ear, he knocked him out cold. A Mr. Farborn beat heads together and fractured someone's skull. A science master thought the marauding village boys were Bolsheviks and fired his shotgun into their retreating rumps. At Grimble's, boys were flogged for tardiness and flogged for untidiness, flogged for apathy and flogged for cheek, and flogged for not improving from the flogging. The fever of war encouraged brutality. The guilt of our non-combatant staff intensified it. The intricacies of the British hierarchical system provided a natural order for the exercise of sadism. Their god was the protector of English country gentlemen, and their justice was the punishment of the ill-born and disadvantaged, and it was meted out with the collaboration of the strong, of whom Sefton Boyd was the strongest and most handsome. It is the saddest of all the ironies of Lipsy's death, as I see it now, that she died in the service of a fascist state. Each leave-out day, on Rick's standing orders, Pym presented himself at the entrance to the school drive, in readiness for Mr. Cudlove's arrival. When nobody appeared, he hurried gratefully to the woods in search of privacy and wild strawberries. Come evening, he returned to the school boasting of the great day he had had. Just occasionally, the worst happened, and a carload would appear. Rick, Mr. Cudlove, Sid in private's uniform, and a couple of jockeys crammed in anyhow, all well refreshed after a pause at the brace of partridges. If a school match was in progress, they would roar support for the home side, and hand round unheard-of oranges from a crate in the boot of the car. If none, then Sid and Morrie Washington would press-gang any boy who happened to be passing on his bicycle, and mount a handicap race round the playing fields, while Sid belted out the commentary through his cupped hands. And Rick, personally, dressed in the admiral's suit, would start them off with a mayoral wave of his handkerchief. And Rick, personally, would present an unimaginable box of chocolates to the winner, while the pound notes changed hands around the court. And when evening came, Rick never failed to install himself